Northwestern University presents the Reviewing Stand, a program in its 12th year on the Mutual Network, a platform which the university shares with guests from business, industry, labor, government, and the press. Today we discuss, should we raise immigration quotas? You can participate in these weekly discussions in two ways. Listen to the facts and opinions of the speakers. Read the printed word-for-word transcript of the discussion. $1 will bring you these pamphlets for the next 26 weeks, $2 for 1 year, 10 cents for a single copy. Write to the Reviewing Stand, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois, or the Mutual Broadcasting System, Chicago, Illinois. The first speaker on today's broadcast, speaking from St. Louis, is Mr. Louis Adamick, author and lecturer. Mr. Adamick.
American history is essentially the story of immigration and immigrants, with the story of their coming over and meeting and mingling here, or working together and creating a new civilization of extraordinary vitality, or creating the great new state in the new world, the state which now has a chance of becoming a tremendous power in the world, a power for good, if we watch our step. Those who like to ignore immigration as a central theme of the American experience have more and more difficulty in giving it meaning. The American Revolution was fought in part because the British regime did not allow free immigration into North America. In other words, the revolution was fought in part to open North America to large-scale immigration. Soon after freedom and independence were won, there began the great inflow of peoples from many countries, from all parts and corners of Europe and also from Asia. In the last 125 years, more than 40 million immigrants came over, and 25 million came in the last half century. In what was a mere moment in history, these millions of newcomers spilled themselves over the new continent, and they grubbed and dug and heaved and lugged, and modern America came into existence. In New York Harbor, for over 60 years now, newly arriving immigrants have been greeted by the lady with the torch, by her pedestal, by the famous words by Emma Lazarus: "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore, send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door." In recent decades, these words have lost much of their meaning. We, or rather our representatives in Washington, have damned the inflow of immigration, permitting only a trickle under the so-called quota system. And now the idea is at large to stop even that trickle. I happen to be speaking to you from the Middle West, from the city of St. Louis. For the last 2 weeks, I've traveled more than 6,000 miles. So this is an immense country. It is sparsely inhabited. Our resources remain vast. There is a lot of room here. But perhaps there is room for 500 million people. Why not let the enormous place be peopled? Let me ask a few other questions. What has happened that of late our long-time hospitality seems to be curling up? Is this part of our present tendency to forget or bypass the best in our tradition, the best in our experience? Who is it that is ready to erase the noble words on the Statue of Liberty? I toss these questions out this Sunday morning from the middle of the country with the suggestion that we pause in the midst of our troubles and think about this and act on it, lest our Congress act rashly and contrary to the essence of America.
Thank you, Mr. Adamick. To continue today's discussion, the Reviewing Stand now takes you to Mutual Studios in Chicago. James H. McBurney, Dean of the School of Speech at Northwestern University, is the moderator. Dean McBurney.
We have heard from Louis Adamick, author of My America, From Many Lands, and most recently, Dinner at the White House. Joining Mr. Adamick on the Reviewing Stand are Mrs. Kenneth F. Rich, Director of the Immigrants Protective League, Clark Lee Allen, Professor of Economics, and William F. Byron, Professor of Sociology, both of Northwestern University. A number of basic assumptions appear to underlie Mr. Adamick's remarks. The assumption that we have a peculiar responsibility to provide refuge for the homeless. That we can profitably absorb 100 or 200 million more population than we have now. That to cut off immigration would be contrary to the essence of America, as he put it. Now, do you people around the table here accept these assumptions? Do they provide a satisfactory philosophy upon which to ground our immigration policy? What is your position, Mrs. Rich?
Mr. Adamick refers in that last remark, I suppose, to radical proposals in the last Congress by certain congressmen from southern states where there are very few immigrants and where population tends to become ingrown, that quotas should be reduced by 50% regardless of country, and that all immigration should be cut off for 10 years, regardless of human ties. I share Mr. Adamick's fear that we may be in danger of forgetting the best in American traditions, sanctuary for the oppressed. My point of view on this subject, I think, may be affected by certain patriotic reasons. He has mentioned the American Revolution. My great-great-grandfather, as a drummer boy in the American Revolution, helped to establish those traditions. The men and women in my family have fought for them ever since. This seems to be a moment in American history when we must again hold up this American ideal to the light and hold it up realistically in the situation in this post-war world.
May we hear from you, Alan?
If our guest were a less distinguished personality, I would feel that his interpretation of American history is extremely naive, and that his hopes for America's participation in the solution of the world's population problem extremely optimistic. It seems to me that American history demonstrates that this country has not been friendly toward unrestricted emigration. Benjamin Franklin, before the Revolutionary War, was very much concerned that immigration from countries where people had relatively little political experience was jeopardizing, particularly the situation in the state of Pennsylvania. Similar warnings came from George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams. As early as 1820, restrictive legislation was enacted, and it seems to me that a general overall increase of immigration would be extremely hazardous, with very dubious benefits to the rest of the world. There are fundamentally only four ways of raising the standard of living in poor and overpopulated countries. First, by greater freedom of international trade, which will extend the markets of such countries. Second, by the investment of foreign capital in them. Third, by an increase in their technical skill and training. Fourth, by a diminution in the pressure of their populations upon the available resources. Emigration applies only to the fourth point and is of limited utility even here.
Well, we've heard from Mrs. Rich. Mr. Allen, where do you stand, Byron?
Well, dear McBurney, I feel there is a wealth of evidence which would support the position that the tradition of right of asylum, from which most of us in this country have benefited greatly, is still of very great value, and not only for us, but for the world situation in general. I think we can keep it alive only if we act in line with it. On the other hand, after having that much of agreement with Mrs. Rich, I move over to Alan's side, and certainly of the opinion that it is very difficult to believe that there is room in this country for this 100 or 200 million more if by that number of people whom we admit, we believe we are going to gain anything. We don't need them from a military point of view because we need fewer people to man atomic weapons. And I don't believe, Alan, that we need them, do we, in industry?
No, the need for population in this country is certainly not great.
Well, I wonder if our immediate immigration problem doesn't stem from the large number of persons who were uprooted from their homes during the war. The displaced persons, right now, more than 1 million such persons are living in camps in Germany and Austria. These are the people who are seeking refuge now, and I wonder if that isn't the group that we're immediately concerned about. Tell us a bit about those people, Byron. Where are they, and what are their circumstances?
Well, I think the most important fact is that instead of speaking about 100 or 200 million, we recognize that the number with whom we are immediately concerned and who are really the basis for our discussion this morning is approximately 1 million in number. And that of that group, about 600,000 are in the American zone. Is that not true, Mr. Rich?
Yes.
How are these displaced persons affected by our immigration laws, Mrs. Rich?
Dean McBurney, we live in a walled country, even in this 20th century. On the one side, that wall is faced with 30 or 40 types and classes of persons who are excluded by a very strict specification from entry into this country. Our immigration policy is highly selective and exclusive, and there is no proposal to amend that policy. There is in the Immigration Act of 1917, which gathers up our policy previously enacted, a very long series of persons, starting with idiots, imbeciles, feeble-minded, epileptic, down through mentally unsound, and persons likely to become a public charge and contract laborers and illiterates, listed persons who cannot enter. In other words, you must be mentally sound and physically fit and morally clean and economically able and politically compatible if you wish to enter this country. And in addition to that, we have a series of immigration quotas, restrictions based at present on national origins, which limit the number to what Mr. Adamick calls a trickle, in round numbers, 153,000 persons who may enter. It's a needle's eye, Dean McBurney, if you were born abroad and wish to enter at this time.
Now, you've really described two acts, the Selective Act of 1917, which is on a qualitative basis, and then the Quota Act of 24, which limits the total number coming in.
Well, of those coming in, only a very small number may come from Eastern and Southeastern Europe, and I gather that is where the greatest demand is going to come from, is it not?
Yes, we have had a shifting quota base during our history since 1921 when the 3% Act was passed. At that time, we based the quota on 3% of the census of 1910. Then the 1924 Act restricted numbers still further to 2% of the foreign-born population as of 1890, which gave a great advantage to persons from Northern and Western Europe. It, for instance, greatly increased the quota for Great Britain and greatly decreased the quota for Germany. The present national origins plan is based on the 1920 census, and when the Immigration Act of 1924 was passed, a great deal was said about Nordic supremacy.
Now, what is the thinking behind this quota system, Alan? Do you go along with that?
I think the present law is a good deal more meaningful if understood in connection with the history of prior legislation on the immigration question. Massachusetts in 1820, New York in 1824, Maryland in 1833 had already enacted restrictive measures. Along with the recently naturalized foreigners flocking to the polls under political bosses in the cities, the Native American Party was formed in 1848. Later, the United American, or Know Nothing Party, actively fought unrestricted. In 1875, Congress passed an act forbidding the importation of prostitutes and alien convicts, and persons obviously unable to take care of themselves were excluded by an act of 1882. As a result of long agitation against cheap Chinese labor in the East as well as on the Pacific Coast, the Chinese Exclusion Act was passed in 1882. Responding to the demands from organized labor, Congress passed in 1885 the Contract Labor Law, a blow at the importation of cheap labor by employers seeking to break strikes or cut wages.
Now, I think that makes your point, Alan, that we've had a long list of immigration acts of one kind or another.
And let me interject that all this was done before the Statue of Liberty was unveiled in 1886 with its invitation to the wretched refuse of foreign lands.
Yes, I think that makes your point. Now, what I want to know is how these displaced persons with whom we are immediately concerned are affected by our present immigration laws. It seems to me that's the real issue here at the moment.
Well, as you were saying, Mrs. Rich, the Northwestern European group is favored. About 110,000 are eligible to come in from that group. But the displaced persons are essentially not from that group. So there would have to be some modification of the law, would there not, in order to provide for the fact that the greatest pressure is from that section of Europe, which is least eligible to apply for admission. Is that not true?
Yes, Professor Byron. Of the million who are left now in the camps, mostly in Germany and Austria, there are predominantly Ukrainians, Yugoslavs, Poles, Estonians, Latvians, Lithuanians, and certain others. There are many who have no country at all, who lost not only their homes and everything, their identity, but their countries. Their citizenship is in question. There have been boundary changes. They have suffered because of political belief. They do not wish to belong to certain former countries of origin. And about, as to religion, about 80% are Christian. About 20% are Jewish.
Well, do you believe that a good deal of opposition to the law arises from those who feel, not knowing the statistics which you just gave, that we would be flooding this country with refugee Jewish people?
We couldn't possibly flood this country with refugees of any one type. Those selective tests, which I indicated, are very severe. They're strictly enforced by American consuls. It really is a needle's eye, person by person, family by family.
Well, now, assuming that we want to do something more than we are now doing for these displaced persons, would you recommend any change in these immigration laws you've been discussing, Mrs. Rich?
Well, could I ask you a question first, apropos of Mr. Adamick's original statement, because it is a tremendously large figure and it startles and astonishes people. What would be the minimum, Mrs. Rich, that you would be content to see brought in here as an emergency measure? Would you agree with Mr. Truman's proposal to bring in 450,000?
Professor Byron, that is the proposal of a certain group of people interested in this question, the Citizens Committee on Displaced Persons. That is a minimum proposal, but it isn't 400,000 or 450,000 in any one year. It's a suggestion that, in addition to the quota, 100,000 a year be permitted to come if they can meet the other tests, 100,000 per year for a period of 3 or 4 years. And we still have the limitation of 10% of the quota in any one month, which means that assimilation is gradual and that the processing, as it's called, is possible by American consuls.
Well, now, to go back to my question, if I may, Mrs. Rich, I take it then that to accomplish this this program that you're discussing of bringing in some 450,000 persons over a period of 3, 4, or 5 years, you'd have to do something with our present immigration laws. Is that right?
Dean McBurney, I have two suggestions within the framework of the idea of quota limitation. One is that there should be a principle of validation of unused quotas. As we look back over the period of the Depression and the war, it's seen that nowhere near the full quota was used. Great Britain has never used more than 7% of her quota. If we merely validated the positions of persons who might have come, who didn't wish to come, who perhaps could not come, we still could hold to the quota principle, but make it possible for them to come now.
Well, we'd validate the quantity, but not the quality, as Alan was pointing out, would we not, Mrs. Rich?
You can't possibly do anything to change the qualification tests in the Act of 1917. No one is proposing it.
Nor would you wish to, I take it.
I'm talking about the quality of the people coming from Eastern and Southeastern Europe versus the quality of the people. Obviously, I am not expressing my own opinion, Mrs. Rich, at this point. But Congress did express itself at that point, did it not, Al?
Yes, I think that's right. At least in the judgment of Congress, right or wrong, there is a qualitative difference depending upon national origin.
Dean McBurney, that seems very old-fashioned to me. We fought at least one war on the principle of equality of peoples. My second point is that we pool the quotas, and it's based on that belief. If we pool the quotas, persons who wish to come, who are able to come, who can meet the tests, can come, and those who do not wish to come surrender their unwanted places.
Well, now, what would be the effect of doing these two things, of validating cumulative quotas back, let's say, to 1939, and making these past quotas available regardless of national origin? Would that accomplish what you're after?
It would do a great deal to relieve the unhappy plight of peoples who have lost their homes, who have not been bombed, who are eagerly wanted by people in this country who would act as their sponsors, who wish to take them into their homes, and especially war orphans who have nothing left at all.
Well, Mr. Fitch, it may be old-fashioned perhaps even to raise this question which Professor Allen and I have raised of quality, but the fact still remains that there is a great deal of opposition on this point. Allen, what is the attitude of the NAM and AFL-CIO on this? Governor Nolan?
The labor organizations have traditionally opposed immigration on the grounds that it provides a source of cheap competition to American laborers. And among the leaders in the movement against unrestricted immigration was Samuel Gompers. It has been consistently the policy to oppose unrestricted immigration. It is further true that the shift has not only been in recent years from Northern Europe to Southern Europe, but there has been a large shift in terms of occupations. There has been an increasing movement from rural to urban areas. And these are all factors which entered into the considerations which Congress made. For example, from 1861 to 1870, only about 31% of the people came from Austria-Hungary. From 1901 to 1910, about 25%. And there are similar figures down the line.
Well, the church groups are in favor as a whole, are they not, Mrs. Rich? Organized church group.
Yes, the church group is, and so in this present day is the American Federation of Labor and the CIO. Each one has passed a strong resolution endorsing this proposal to rescue at least 400,000 of these people. And as to occupation, it does meet, in a sense, Professor Allen's point, because in a careful study of the occupational skills of refugees now in the camps, it was found that a minimum of 60,000 are agriculturalists. They could go to our abandoned farms. We could have more meat. We could have less expensive cheese. We could have more sugar. 18,000 are mechanically and industrially skilled. 4,000 are nurses. 7,000 are teachers. 4,000 are engineers. 3,000 are physicians.
Well,
there are said to be, Professor Byron, 20,000 housemaids, which will interest some people.
May I speak to Mrs. Rich's point? Incidentally, your reference to housemaids is enormously interesting, Mrs. Rich. But apart from that, yours is the first argument I've heard here today that there is any particular reason for admitting these people other than on humanitarian grounds. Now, Allen has been arguing with some consistency here that we really don't need more immigrants. Do you continue in that position?
Yes. I think it should be clear that labor organizations, and it would be my own personal position, labor organizations take the view that in the present emergency, there may be something that we can do by way of relaxing immigration rules. And insofar as we can be useful, we should do it. But in the long run, and as overall policy, the standard of living of a country depends upon the proportion between its people and its capital. If the population is great, without a corresponding increase in capital, standards of living invariably and inevitably will fall. I am accordingly opposed to an increase in total immigration as a long-run policy.
Well, now, even as a short-run policy, do we need these 400,000 people that Mrs. Rich is talking about?
If we could have an additional 400,000 immediately and could find a place for them to live, many labor shortages would be ameliorated. 6 months from now, it may be that we will have unemployment, and an additional influx of foreigners, even in the short run, might be highly detrimental, not only to America, but to the immigrants themselves, because in a depression period, an alien is an ugly word.
Well, I was going to ask Mr. Rich this. We seem to be going on the assumption here that while we all agree upon the importance of doing something in this emergency situation, that the thing which we are accepting is bringing these people here rather than, shall we say, using the International Refugee Organization, which I gather has appropriated $150 million to take care of these several hundred thousand of the DPs in the camps over there.
Professor Byron, we admit the advantages of caring for people on their own home ground when they wish to be there, of supplying tools and machinery and cows and food and seeds, making it possible for them to rebuild Europe. Of course, some of those who suffered most in Germany are not interested in rebuilding Germany. On the other hand, it does seem to me of much more than humanitarian interest, although nothing perhaps could be of greater interest, to us to let them come because a friendly world means national safety and security. And if in the midst of our plenty we stand off cold to the needs of hunger and starvation, lack of food, lack of medicines, the United States will be a hated world, and that means future wars, and it means America's children and grandchildren will pay.
But do you believe that there are organizations in this country then, women's organizations and others, which should bring pressure to bear upon the House Committee on Immigration and Naturalization to go forward at once with this study which they proposed when they said that there should be no general alteration or detailed revision of any major area of the immigration laws until they'd had this study? Do you think that is one thing that we could do?
Studies are always advantageous, but we know, Professor Byron, in this instance, I believe in action now to save lives.
Americans can't be indifferent to the sufferings of humanity. My point is simply that that suffering will be relieved in only a very minor degree by such immigration as we can absorb. We can provide them with capital so that they can increase their standards at home. There are other areas of the world that need migratory labor. Insofar as migration is a solution, it will be predominantly to other lands such as Australia and South America.
Now, in brief conclusion, the position of this panel appears to be that we should at least make adjustments within our present immigration quotas to accommodate several hundred thousand displaced persons who would otherwise be denied admission. I think that Mrs. Rich and Mr. Adamick would view this as a minimum program and very much hope that we could do better. I think Mr. Allen and Mr. Byron, while in accord with this minimum program, Mr. Allen perhaps a little reluctantly, I think they oppose a general long-run policy of increasing the total immigration for reasons which you have heard.
Thank you, gentlemen, and you, Mrs. Rich. You have been listening to the Northwestern University Reviewing Stand discussion, Should We Raise Immigration Quotas? We invite you to subscribe now for copies of the Reviewing Stand weekly discussions. $1 for the next 6 months, $2 for an entire year. A printed copy of today's discussion may be purchased for 10 cents in coin. Write to the Reviewing Stand, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois, or to the Mutual Broadcasting System, Chicago, Illinois. Participating as guests today were Louis Adamick, author and lecturer, Mrs. Kenneth F. Rich, director of the Immigrants Protective League, Clark Lee Allen, assistant professor of economics, and William F. Byron, assistant professor of sociology, both of Northwestern University. Our moderator, James H. McBurney, will now tell you about next week's program.
Next week, we discuss military influence in government. Guest speakers will be Herbert C. Holdridge, Brigadier General in the United States Army, retired, Ray Ireland, Vice President of the United Airlines, and Marshall Dimmock, Professor of Political Science at Northwestern University. We invite you to listen.
Remember, friends, you are invited to subscribe for copies of the Reviewing Stand Weekly Discussions, $1 for the next 6 months, $2 for an entire year. The Northwestern University Reviewing Stand is broadcast coast to coast each week as a public service feature of Mutual. Walt Newton speaking, this is the Mutual Broadcasting System.